Mac Power Users, episode 737, Scoring a Movie with David Metzger. Hello, everyone. This is David Sparks. I'm here joined by my pal, Stephen Hackett. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm good, David. How are you?
I am fantastic. And we've got a returning guest to us. Welcome back to the show, David Metzger.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on again.
I really enjoyed the show we did with you. David, for the audience, is a very well-known and reputable musician who does a lot of work in Hollywood. He's worked on movies like Lion King, Kung Fu Panda, Bolt. The list literally in our outline just keeps going, you know? But most importantly, as we talked about in our last episode, David used to score and arrange for Maynard Ferguson. So to me, that is always going to be the first thing I say about you, David.
There we go. The boss. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Maynard Ferguson, for the audience, is a really infamous trumpet player. He's just a wild man. And he was a Canadian guy who played really high notes. And anybody who worked with Maynard has like probably 1,000 great stories. And but we're not going to do that today. Steven's here to keep me in line. That, you know, the whole thing with Maynard and the gap in his teeth. When I was in high school, I knew people that were trying to put gaps in their teeth because they thought that was the trick to get like high notes. Yeah,
self dentistry. That's not the best way to go for high notes.
Yeah, yeah,
not good.
Yeah, but Dave. So Dave, we're gonna dig into your career a little bit. But the big goal for today, David. In addition to all the other things he did, he just wrote the score for Disney's new movie Wish. And this is a big deal because you did a lot of arranging on a lot of these movies, but this movie, you scored it. You are the composer. And when I saw, I was telling you before we started recording, when I saw the poster with your name on it, I just got goosebumps. I was so happy for you because I know you've had this career that's slowly been building up to this, and now you are scoring movies. And for the audience, we're going to talk through what that process is. But also, David is a huge Apple nerd. And I think of all the people I know, you have the most things connected to your Mac. So we're going to be talking about that. Yeah, you have a lot of gear. I know, David.
Don't tell my wife.
yeah. Well, okay, we won't tell. Don't tell her you're on the show. Because we're going to get into all that today. But I guess I just wanted to start by congratulating you. That is such a big deal, scoring the movie Wish.
Oh, thank you so much, David. That means a ton to me. I really do appreciate that. I was saying, you know, before we recorded, that it really literally was a dream come true for me. It's something that I dreamed of since I was 16 years old. And so that's coming up, getting close to 50 years now. Oh, gosh. And it's something I never thought was really going to happen. So to have it actually happen, and especially at this time of my career, and on a film that I loved so much, really was the ultimate for me. So thank you for that.
We do have a little housekeeping before we dive into all of that. I just wanted to let everybody know that our very own David Sparks was on the Relay Members Only podcast Spotlight this month. If you're not familiar with Spotlight, Kathy Campbell, who's our community manager at Relay, collects questions from members and asks them of David. And I just want to highlight one answer. A question was asked if David needed to pick a co-host to get him safely across the country in some sort of misadventure, who would be the person he'd want to do that? And he picked me. I'm going to ignore the fact that you said I was tightly wound, but which is true. But I was, you know, David, I'd be honored to help you get across the country if it comes to that.
I feel like if I was in trouble and I needed somebody at my back for anything, I feel like it'd be you, Stephen. I feel like you're kind of guy that would get it done too. You'd get me there, whatever the problem was. But I also, the point I made is that you are, as I say this with love, you are a person who's very specific about things, and I'm a little more loosey-goosey, and I feel like that if somebody were following us and filming this cross-country journey, that there would be a lot of comedic relief in there, as you were frustrated with many of my mannerisms and actions. I'm just thinking.
It would be a good buddy movie, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we would.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, buddy film I see on the horizon here.
Yeah, I think David Metzger could score it. No, we can't afford him. No. Yeah. Yeah. Also today on More Power Users, there's a rumor now of mat displays, high and low everywhere. We're going to talk about that. But let's get back to the guest, Dave. I jumped right in. I was very excited. Just tell us a little bit about your background, David, and how you kind of got to this point.
Yeah, well, I'll try to keep it brief because I can talk forever on this topic. So shut me down. Give me the sign, if I'm going too long. But anyway, I was born into a very non-musical family. I always say my dad was tone deaf. Well, he was. And the only way he could recognize the Star Spangled Banner was by the lyrics, by the words. And so and my mom didn't play any instruments or anything. But the one thing she did do was she always had recordings going on in the background when I was a little kid. So I think that I maybe absorbed something osmosively, I guess would be the word.
Sure.
From that. But really, I just went through the basic kind of any kid, in America, I suppose, growing up in the 60s, music education where we had like a music class once a week for 30 minutes. And in third grade, we played recorders and all that kind of stuff. Right. And, but though never had any interest in music other than I liked listening a lot, but, and then, in seventh grade, I was going to junior high. It was new school. I wanted to be in a shop class, a wood shop class, and the class was full. And so the administrators then in their wisdom, it turns out actually was true, put me randomly in the choir class. And it turned out that the choir director was one of the top composers of choral music for junior high students in America. And so I got into that class and noticed right away that a lot of the music we were singing was music she'd composed. And so I was inspired then at that first Christmas vacation to do an arrangement of Barbara Ann, the old Beach Boys, Jan and Dean song, right? And and so I just did a four-part vocal arrangement of Barbara Ann, not knowing what I was doing. I couldn't play any instruments. And so I just went straight from my head to paper. And looking back, I don't even really know how I did that, right? That how I would know enough correlation, except I suppose just the early education in grade school. But and she saw it when I showed it to her, then after coming back from vacation, she saw it and was, I think, noticed that there was something, there to nurture. So she then really took me under her wing from that point on. And I kind of caught the fire and started writing pretty much constantly whenever I wasn't doing anything else. I just sit at home and write. And I would bring the music in, and she would then, everything that I would write, she would take the time in the class to read through, to at least read through. And then eventually got to the point where she was putting them on the concerts, our school concerts. And by the time I was in ninth grade, it was going to the festivals. When you go around in school groups, you go around to different festivals. So I was getting great feedback, hearing the work that I was doing right away when I was very young. It was like, I think 12. I was 12 when I first did my first kind of writing thing. So high school, I switched over to band, the band program. And also in ninth grade, took my first year of college music theory. And so it was like, I was getting this great, and so I started writing instrumental music then in high school. Again, my band director was always willing to play anything that I did. And then got a great listening list from my professor in college of, hipping me to classical music. So Stravinsky, Beethoven, Copland, Penderecki, all these like things. So he taught me how to go to the music library, check out the score, and then also the record, the 33, and then sit. And so I would sit and listen for hours and read the scores. So these great classical pieces. And this is in ninth grade, starting ninth grade. So that's essentially how I learned how to orchestrate. Because whenever I would hear something that would catch my ear, I would stop the recording and look at the score and analyze what made that sound. So I kind of, that was my orchestration tutorial, really, And then at age 16, I saw a very small film, Star Wars, the original Star Wars. I don't know.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Not familiar. That? Okay, well, check it out. You might find it interesting. No, but anyway, so like so many people, I was just enthralled. And we're talking the first one, episode 4. And just was completely entranced by how music worked with picture. And so from that point on, that was what I wanted to do, was to be a film composer. Essentially, it turned out to being my career. It took a while to get to the actual composing stage, but eventually made it. But so then I had grown up in Oregon. I don't think I mentioned that. In Oregon, especially at that point, there wasn't really much film music going on or any way to get in. I didn't know how to do it because my parents, were wonderful parents, but didn't have any experience in what to do. And my teachers, as great as they were band and choir directors in Oregon. So all I knew is that you had to go to LA, it seemed like, because that's where the industry was. And so went to college in Southern California, kind of climbed the ranks. I was on the 7-year graduation program for my undergrad.
Me too. I did that too.
a fellow traveler. But then got married at 22, kind of did everything in LA in my 20s, like you have to do to survive. I copied music for other composers. I played a lot of gigs. I was a bass player. I arranged a lot of jazz band charts. Eventually got to the Maynard Ferguson connection that David alluded to earlier, was his arranger for a couple of years, worked for the Ice Capades, which was is now long defunct, but it was a great experience for arranging different styles of music for ice skaters and in a professional environment. Yeah. Learned a lot doing that, actually did that for about 3 or 4 years. Got to the age of 31, hadn't worked for a year. Literally a year, I had no jobs. My first son was born. My wife, who is from Oregon, also said, I'm going back to Oregon with our kid. You can come if you want to. And I didn't really have much of a reason to stay, because I thought, well, I'd give it a shot, and nothing happened. So we moved back to Oregon when I was 32. But right before that, about 2 weeks before we moved, I got called from a friend who had been hired to be the music supervisor for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, right when Jay had taken over from Johnny Carson. They needed a whole new book. Branford Marsalis was the music director, band leader at that point. And so he was in charge of getting arrangers or composers to write charts. So he asked if I'd be interested in doing it, not knowing that I was moving to Oregon in 2 weeks, because I hadn't told anybody. And so I wrote 5 charts that first week. Took him in to NBC, and Branford liked what I'd done. And I thought, well, at this point, I better tell him I'm moving to Oregon. And this is 1992, mind you, so it's way before the internet. Yeah. And Finale, what was it like? I don't even know. Finale 2.0, maybe. I don't know. But Branford said, well, they've got fax machines up in Oregon, don't they? So, which indeed they did. So upon moving to Oregon for the first 5 years, I wrote about 250 charts for The Tonight Show, all from Oregon. And I would write them in, start out the day before when they would need them. They'd tell me what kind of music they need, and I'd write it and fax them down to Burbank, and they would rehearse them and record, play them on air. And it got to the end of that run where I was getting called, they would rehearse at 3:30 and tape at 5:30. And I was getting called at the end of my run there, at 12:30, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And so I would have to knock out this arrangement. And it got to the point where I couldn't get it done, obviously, by the rehearsal. So they would then sight read the music on the air. So that was actually pretty, scary in some ways, but it was great because it really got my Finale chops together and my bulletproof kind of thing that I think I'm sort of known for, I suppose, in some way. But anyway, I'll jump ahead. Sorry, I'm talking way too long. But
No, this is interesting, though, because, so many people listening, I know there's a lot of musicians listening that are on that journey, and they're trying to figure it out for themselves. And, sometimes fate steps in, it seems.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment, because I think it's really true. I think my whole journey was really full of these fateful moments that I've skipped over a lot of them, but just, there were pivotal, important steps of life that if they would have gone a different way, I would be selling insurance. Nothing wrong with selling insurance, but I wouldn't have had the career that I had, So anyway, jumped up. Tonight Show eventually ended after 5 years. I thought I was back to selling insurance, maybe, I was 37 at that point. And then fate again intervened, and out of the blue, I got called by a friend of mine, a dear friend, Don Harper, in Southern California, who needed help, asked if I would be interested in helping orchestrate a feature film, and that he'd been hired to orchestrate. And it was a film called Speed 2, not Speed 1. It was Speed 2, the one on the cruise ship that didn't do quite as well. But anyway, the important thing about that is I orchestrated a chunk of that film, went down to the sessions, met Mark Mancina, who was the composer of the score, and Mark and I hit it off. The next thing Mark, I knew, about a month after we finished working on that film, Mark called and said he'd been hired by Disney to produce the music for the Broadway version of The Lion King. The guy who had been hired to be the orchestrator had just pulled out. Would I be interested in stepping in and doing that? And so there's another huge fate moment, right, in my career, because I, The Lion King, the Broadway version of The Lion King is still running in New York 27 years later. I think it's got like 10 companies around the world still going. It's just coming upon 25 years in London that it's been running. So the highest grossing Broadway show in history, all the kind of amazing things that I just walked right or fell into, right? It just fell out of the sky, and very fortunate that I was able to be engaged in that. And then that solidified my relationship with Mark fairly shortly after Lion King. Then he was hired to write, compose the score for Tarzan, the Disney animation film Tarzan, which then at that point, he trusted me. We had a great relationship. So I orchestrated every second of Tarzan, working with Phil Collins on the songs, did a little bit of behind the scenes composing on it, you know, and as well. So that was my entryway into Disney animation. That was my entry point. And this was 1999. So that's 25 years ago. Wow.
Now let me interrupt there just for a second for folks listening. The terms may be confusing for some. Composing versus orchestration. Could you explain that?
Yeah. So composer, it kind of varies depending on who's composing and what field you're working in. In its basic form, a composer is the person who writes the melodies and comes up with the harmony parts. Some composers, like myself, when I'm composing, I do all of the arranging as well, as far as I write not only the melodies, but I write all the counter melodies. I figure out all the things in very detail, not just the melody and the harmony. But at its root, a composer will be responsible for the melodies and chord changes, you might say. Then an orchestrator or an arranger really will take that and then we'll flesh it out and we'll write counter melodies, we'll figure out more detailed harmony parts, things like that. And then an orchestrator at the end of the game will take in today's world, it's always a MIDI mockup. There's very few people who actually write a score by hand anymore. I mean, like I don't even, John Williams is like, he'll write a sketch, you know, and his orchestrator will look at that, yeah, you know, take that 8-stave sketch and blow it up into a full score. But in today's world, an orchestrator will take the MIDI file from the composer or the arranger and essentially transcribe that into a playable score of written music, like we traditionally see and that the musicians will read their parts off of. Sometimes an orchestrator has to fill in the holes and decide what, it's not only decide what instruments to play, but a lot of times composers are moving so fast, they will overwrite. They'll write like it would take 4 string orchestras to play all the notes, right? And so, you know, because you're just flying through there and depending on how a person writes, they're going to do that. So a lot of times an orchestrator's job in those cases is to reduce down all of those string parts into something that will actually be playable by a real studio orchestra. Mm-hmm. But it's a very wide-ranging swath of experiences that orchestrators' responsibilities and skill sets are anymore. So anyway, so when I was orchestrating, it depended. It would fill into, depending on the composer I was working for, sometimes it would be I'd have to fill in a lot of gaps. Sometimes it would be I'd have to reduce things a lot. And sometimes it's just a kind of a literal straight transcription of what the composer's MIDI file is, to make it into a playable format, taking it from the dashes you know, that are going to be in a key editor window. I hope I'm not getting too technical here, but, you know, like one way to view MIDI data is with just little dashes on, you know, in a window that represent the pitch and the length of the, yeah, of the note. So, you know, so sometimes an orchestrator will just be transcribing that and turning it into more into traditional notation that a musician would be able to read.
This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by NetSuite. Go to netsuite.com/MPU for the leading integrated cloud business software suite. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, multiple systems, and delivering your product or services, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. I can tell you even my little business suffers from these problems. Trying to keep unified data in one place where we have one source of truth is difficult, and it costs us money when we don't know what's going on. I can only imagine what it would be like with a larger company. The more people and the more data sources you have, the harder it gets, and you need to find ways to cut costs and boost business performance. And NetSuite is the proven answer for that, with 37,000 companies already on board. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/MPU, that's NetSuite.com/MPU. That link once again is netsuite.com/MPU. Go there and check it out. And our thanks to NetSuite for their support of the Mac Power Users and all of Relay FM. So you got in there and you got a reputation as this top flight orchestrator. I didn't even finish the list. Wreck-It Ralph, Avengers, Frozen, Wish. I mean, all this stuff goes on and on your website, all the stuff you did. But then you recently got the big call on the next step in your career. So tell us about your relationship with Wish.
Yeah. You know, I'd pretty much given up any hope. I'm 63 years old, you know, and so I've kind of been around a long time, and I had thought my career was just sort of destined to run out as a arranger orchestrator. I've kind of also gotten this fallen into the song arranger thing for films, where starting with Frozen, I was hired to arrange the songs in all these films, you know, and so I've had this whole 14, 12, 13 year career of song arranging. But I sort of thought that was what my path was going to be. I was going to be, you know, an arranger, an additional music composer guy in films, and probably most likely a song arranger, you know. And then out of the blue, even though I still had this burning desire, you know, dream to want to be a composer of a score on a film. But out of the blue, I was recording in London, and I got a phone call from Matt Walker, who's the head of music for Disney Animation Department, the studio. And Matt was saying, well, you know, we're, you know, putting you up to be a composer on this film. And is it something you'd be interested in doing? He just wanted to make sure that I would be interested beforehand. And I've known Matt for 25 years, you know, and I thought, oh, Matt, you're just like, you're kidding. You know, this is not a funny joke. You know, why would you tell a joke like this? You know, I didn't say that, but I was thinking, oh, this is, can't be real. But but of course I said, sure, you know, I would love to be considered, you know, thinking there's no way, because he didn't tell me much about the film, but he said it would be for their major release of a year. They do one big film a year. And I thought, well, this is great. I appreciate it very much that you'd consider this, but I'm thinking there's no way, because literally every composer in the world would jump at this opportunity. You know, even the most experienced people would love to be able to score, be the composer on a Disney animated film. It's just kind of a, it's a very rare opportunity. There's only been 60 something of them made going back to Snow White in 1937, you know, and so I thought there's no way they're going to pick me. Why would they pick me? I didn't have a track record as a composer. Sure. I've worked on, I don't know, I think 11 maybe of those 60 something films of Disney animation over the history, and I have a relationship with that studio, but there's no way they'd hire me as a composer. So Matt said, well, I'll keep you posted, you know, and I didn't hear anything for about, I don't know, 4 months. And I thought, okay, well, it went somewhere else and that's fine. So I thought, well, I'll just reach back to him and I'll see, you know, had they make any decisions. He said, well, you know, so I called him up and he said, well, they're still deciding. And in fact, this week, they're going to probably make the final decision. And I said, oh, well, I'm probably out of it. He said, no, you're still kind of in it, you know? So then I thought, well, okay, this is great. You know, I at least got this far in the process. But then it was probably a couple of weeks later, I got a call back from Matt. And then also on the call was Tom McDougall, who is the head of all music for all Disney studios now. Previously, he'd been the head of Disney animation film before moving up, and then Matt took his job. But I've known Tom for 25 years, going back to Tarzan, and he's been a real he's been my guardian angel. Actually, is how I kind of look at Tom. He's the one who hooked me up with the Lopez's, Bobby and Kristen Lopez, for Frozen. And he's always been looking out for me, where he can use me in different projects. So then they both got on the phone and they said, you know, congratulations, I've been hired to be the composer of Wish. And it's like, and I literally screamed because I thought, oh, this is impossible, you know, but was so excited to have it. And after we hung up, I went and told my wife, and she started crying, and we're both crying. They're hugging each other, you know, like it literally was this ultimate dream come true for me. So that's how I found out about it. And as a part of it too, it was kind of a twofer in a way. They actually hired me to be the composer of a short called Once Upon a Studio. I don't know if you guys have seen that
at all. You did that too? Yes.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful little short. I didn't know you did that too.
Yeah, that was, actually I did that before Wish because it was needing to be finished beforehand. But that was like a absolutely gem of a project. You know, I got to write in the style of all these classic Disney films. If people haven't seen it yet, I'd really encourage them to see it. It's on Disney Plus, and I think it's on YouTube. I think you can see it too, but a lovely short, really beautiful film. And so anyway, that's kind of how I found out. And then, you know, we can talk about the experience, or I'll let you lead, you know, as what you want to hear.
Well, let me just tell you a little bit from my angle, because Daisy, my wife, at one point was giving studio tours. She like bring people to Walt's office and whatnot. So I would go up to Burbank and see her there once in a while. And they have in the animation, the old animation building on the lot, they have posters for the upcoming. So that's the first place the poster gets posted. It's just for employees. Right. And I saw your name on it and I just flipped out and I'm like, David pulled it off. You're a composer. So look, as a Mac Power user, we are all very proud of you. And gang, listen, Wish is coming on Disney Plus soon. And that short, Once Upon a Studio, to me is very, it's just emotionally, like, it's so good. I mean, it just really, it really hits you in the feels. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend we all need to support David and check this out. But I'm very, very happy that you have made this big jump. And selfishly, that gives us a couple things for today's show. Now that I've buttered you up, I want to talk through the process of this. I mean, we've never had someone on the show who composed a major movie score. And I know you do all this with Apple Gear. So, and we are going to get to the dessert later of all the stuff you've got plugged in, but what's involved in that process? I mean, they call you and say, you've got the gig, but now you've got to like write the music for a major motion picture. I don't even know where you would get started with that.
Well, it's my experience was pretty typical, actually. So in a nutshell, the first thing that you do is you have a meeting with the director. In this case, there were two directors, and the producers, and then the music, you know, Matt Walker and Tom McDougall, we're all in, and Jen Lee, who's the head of the studio, we're all in kind of a meeting where we watched the film, and we're, I jumped in early, actually, too, because I was also arranging and orchestrating the songs in the film. So not only was I composing the score, but I was in charge of you know, getting the songs arranged in to fit. And I think in a way I was appealing to them also because they knew I could do the songs, so I'd done Frozen, Frozen 2, Moana, I don't know, other film, going back to Tarzan, you know. And so they knew I could do that side of it. But I think they were looking to have cohesiveness between the score and the songs. So I really started working on the songs first. And so the first 6 months I was involved on the film, it was working with the songs. The songs were written by Julia Michaels and Ben Rice. They're really wonderful, wonderful people and really great musicians too. And so I had a really great time with them. And also they're much, much younger than me. So it was a chance to like learn some new words, you know, so the first 6 months it was really working on the songs. The songs are integral to an animated film or any musical because they're a part of the story arc, right? Because you have the lyric, the words that are going on in the songs that are advancing the story. So they're written in conjunction with developing the film and the whole story. So I worked with Julie, Ben, and the team, and we eventually got to the point of where we were recorded the songs. We got those recorded, I think it was in February when we were done with the songs. No, actually, that's not correct. We started in February recording. We finished in June working on the songs. And then I flipped over to the score. And so I was composing the score. It's a situation where I had the meeting with the directors and producers, and we watched through the film and take notes on where the music can start and where it's going to end and what kind of music the directors are envisioning, you know, what's the root of the scene, you know, what are they hoping that the scenes can convey and what can I do to help support that musically. There's a music editor involved too. Actually, I was very fortunate to have two amazing music editors working with me. So they're taking notes all this time. Then they prepare a spreadsheet, a program. Actually, they're using a program. And I've forgotten the name of it. But anyway, I'll remember it if you want me to talk to it. But anyway, so it's just a software spreadsheet, essentially, that details all those notes. And so I can refer to that as I'm writing, and I can see how long a scene is and any notes the directors might have talked about, you know, like what the goal is. And so
let me interrupt there for a second, though. That's something that's always fascinated me, you know, is the timing of music. I mean, it's hard enough to make music, right? But then you've got to make music that fits into a clip that is, you know, 2 minutes and 37 seconds long. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't even know musically how you do that. Like, do you adjust the tempo or the time signature or whatever? And like, do you know that going in? Does that change during the process? I mean, how does that work? And then how do you like capture that? I mean, what software are you using to write music that can fit that exact window, but be adjustable if you need it to be?
Yeah, I'll come back to the software point after describing the process. So let's say there's a 2 minute cue, and it's what you do is you manipulate the tempos. And you change the meters. Like if you look at a score for a film music, you know, like a classical score, it's going to be like 4-4 all the way through, right? I mean, unless it's Stravinsky or something, you know, but like Beethoven, you look at a Beethoven score, it's going to be all one meter all the way through. You look at a film score, every other bar, it's like a 5-4 and a 2-4 followed by a 3-4 followed by, there's going to be a 4-4, maybe a 7-8 in there or something. And those are your two tools. You have tempo and you have meter. To make things work, fit musically. So what I do, and most people I think do, is they'll watch a scene and they'll look for the moments that they really need to hit. So like if there's a door slamming and you know you want to have a real big, strong downbeat on that door slam, you get the video, you're writing to the video. So, and every frame of the video has a unique time code number. It's a SMPTE time code. And so you can... and there are 24 frames in film in a second. So there's 24 pieces of individual pictures to make up 1 second. So what I do is I will roll up to where, well, my music editor's actually made the note already usually, but I'll roll up to where that door slam is. And then I'll also have been playing around with the theme that I'm thinking about putting there. And so I'm figuring out roughly what tempo it's going to be, what's going to be a ballpark range. And then the computer software is so darn good anymore. I mean, it has been for a long time, that it will help you calculate out. You can drag the beat that you want to land on that door frame to line up with the door frame, and it'll calculate out your tempo. Hmm. And so as long as you're in the ballpark of the tempo that you kind of, that piece of music has to live in to be right, you're there. So it's actually it's a big giant puzzle, right? I look at all of my job as a big puzzle.
I'm sure.
But that's a part that the computer really helps, you know, that it will line you up with where you are. And so then you have to do that for all those hit points that you really want to catch in the scene.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
So it's not even just making it 2 minutes and 37 seconds long. It's also got to land like a certain note at a certain point at the 10 second spot and at the at the 62 second spot. So
correct.
You've got all this. Now, would you, I guess you would, I'm just kind of thinking it through logically. Do you just do like the primary melody to get the tempo and everything laid down?
Yep.
And then you go back and do all the orchestration.
Exactly right. What I do is a very common way to work. And I couldn't imagine doing it any other way. So I have a piano sound loaded up in my software. I use Cubase, by the way, and we can talk more about that down the road, but I have a piano track and I call it Guide Piano. And so that's what I will use to mark out my melodies and my, you know, rough chord progressions or whatever, to make sure that way I can tell if it's going to work and land at the right place. And so, and because it's just a piano part, it's not nearly as complicated. When I was young, it was wrong, right? I would try to write, start writing with the clarinet part and then followed with the string. So I would get ahead of, I put the horse or the cart ahead of the horse, right? Where I was trying to get too detailed, when at first you really just want to block it out with the very simple piano part to get, and then that way you can get the flow too of the scene. And you can tell, okay, this is too fast. And if it's too fast, you got to take some notes out and then slow down the tempo, right? And so until you finally settle on what feels like it's right for you. And then I dive into writing the string parts and writing the percussion parts and all that stuff. So
you mentioned it's like dumping over a box of puzzle pieces. When you're at this phase where you're roughing stuff in, is animation complete, or are you working against something that could move out from under you as time moves on?
Right. That's a great question, Stephen. It's in animation, things are more likely traditionally to be locked earlier. Ideally, a composer is not going to work on a scene until it's locked, until it's not going to change anymore editorially. In reality, that kind of never happens. in live action, things change like every day. Hmm. And so a big part of that job is trying to keep up with chase the edits, the film edits. And so, but in Wish, I was very fortunate. By the time that I was really engaged embarking on composing the score, it was pretty set. There were a few scenes that trimmed a second here or there, or, they added 3 frames, as we discussed, that would be just a fraction of a second, So it's always changing somewhat, but I was very fortunate that in which I didn't have a whole lot of really major issues I had to deal with because of edits. The animation I see it's not finished because there's so many layers of animation process. You start with animatronics, which are essentially just hand drawn. There'll be 2 seconds of one picture that, okay, this is going to be, a character walking down a hallway, but there'll just be one card of a very roughly hand-drawn, sure, beautifully, but roughly hand-drawn picture of that character, mm-hmm, in a pose, but, and then eventually that gets filled in with, rough animation, and then it gets to a final animation point, but that still doesn't mean that the lighting is done. There's still lighting and there's still all these other steps to go. But in Wish, I was very fortunate that most of the stuff I was working with was at least rough animation. There weren't a whole lot of storyboard cards I was writing to, so that's kind of helpful. But other films, I've written whole cues, you know, where I was not the composer, but I was writing additional music. I've written whole cues to where it's just a big, giant series of storyboards, you know. And so, but that's kind of the process. Again, live action is a whole different beast because it changes all the time.
Another question for me, and I know this has no relation to Mac Power users, but it's always been curious to me, is, I mean, to me, a film composer, like the person who does the work you're doing, your primary job is to write emotion into scenes. Like, yeah. You know, I mean, like you talked about that space movie from the old days. Like if you watch it without John Williams' score, you don't get it. Just don't get it. And it's like the emotion that comes out of the music always like cues us as a viewer, what we're supposed to be feeling now, and enhances the feelings we already have. But like, how do you learn to write emotion into music?
Yeah. You know, and David, that's a really great observation. That's exactly what, you know, a film composer is really, you're really at the service of the director and the film, right? You know, your job is to convey what the director wants. It's not about you. They've hired you because of your voice, but it's, but it really is, at the end of the day, you know, what the director is looking for, that's your job. So that being said, you know, I think the way I learned how to write emotionally was I just watched a bajillion movies, right? It drives my wife nuts, but I'm a TCM and Criterion, you know, addict, you know, Turner Classic Music, you know, movies. And so, especially for me, it's like older films, you know, where obviously that style doesn't really fly and, you know, styles have changed, but there's so much, that I learned by just watching endlessly great movies, you know, and I don't have a problem with watching a film 30, 40 times, you know, over my lifetime, if it speaks to me. And so I think I just absorbed, you know, that by watching so much, stuff. I'll also throw out there, you know, that when I was a really little kid and before I even knew about music, I watched, and this is going to sound horrible, but I watched a lot of Gilligan's Island, you know, and so, you know, and it's a goofy show, right? But the music was pretty darn great as far as capturing, you know, what was kind of going on and laying that bed of place and time, you know? And mm-hmm. so I really kind of like learned a lot just from watching, you know, things and I think that's it. You can't really be taught it, I guess, writing emotion, but you can certainly learn it. But I think it's one of those deals where you just got to experience it. You know, you just got to do it a ton. You know, I think we talked before, David, you know, I'm a big fan of this 10,000 hours kind of concept, you know, that you do something for 10,000 hours and you're going to get pretty decent at it. And I got my 10,000 hours under my belt really young, you know, and so it's just by doing it more and more and more and being open to different approaches and different styles of music and like, you know, and always looking for things that you can incorporate into your bag of, you know, of tools, your toolbox, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I feel about it.
And I know we have a lot of musicians that listen to this show and like a lot of people say, well, you use minor chords for sadness. But I feel like there's a lot more to it than that. Like that's like the shallowest level of this stuff. And like watching Wish, your music was moving me emotionally. It was pulling me in. And I just feel like that is, you know, that's a beautiful gift that you have.
Oh, well, yeah. I appreciate that very much.
How do you consider those things? It feels like it's one thing for the music to be part of the film or the show, right? Where you have color and light and picture, but your work also has to stand on its own if people are listening to the soundtrack. Right. And as a parent of three kids, I've listened to plenty of the Frozen soundtrack on the way to school over the years.
Sorry about that.
Do you, when you're in this creative mode, when you're putting these things together, is that a consideration that also has to stand alone? Or is that secondary and the main thing is, hey, we want to make the best movie that we can?
Yeah. Well, Stephen, you know, the first thing always, again, that has to be serviced is the film, right? But while you're working and while you're writing, you are thinking about the soundtrack because, especially on a Disney film, people are going to be listening to the music outside of just viewing the film too. So sometimes, you know, jumping ahead, sometimes we'll record in the studio a separate ending, you know, so that like that will be just for the soundtrack release only, right? That it's not going to ever be used in the film, but it'll be used to make an ending, you know, make sense, as opposed to, you know, sometimes you have to, for servicing the film, you have to do bizarre things sometimes, you know, to make it happen. And so we'll record these different soundtrack, you know, moments. But I kind of feel like the way I write, you know, who I am is a, and I don't want to use the word traditional, you know, because I don't want to, you know, put myself in a box, and I already have used the word and I put myself in a box, but I think I always respond, as we've talked, you know, just we're talking about, I love, you know, I love melodies, you know, that isn't necessarily in vogue in film music at the moment, you know, like it's sometimes, it's more about, and that's fine. You know, some films don't need a strong melody. They need, you know, an underpinning of a bed that's going to convey the tension, or, you know, is going to service the film in that way. You know, I particularly happen, I can do that. I've written that style before, but I like melodies, you know, so, and to me, that's part of the joy, is because if you have a melodic score, it's going to be interesting to listen to, you know, I think as well. Sometimes you'll listen to cues from a film and they work great in the film, but they're going to be a little boring if you're just listening. You know, you aren't going to necessarily put it on as a piece of music to like listen to in the background or to analyze in, you know, in a deep study way or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know? So that's why I kind of gravitate towards melodies and interesting harmonies, and not always, not always in a traditional sense of harmony, but in a more, sometimes it'll be a more interesting 21st century way of looking at the harmony, writing, harmonic writing. But yeah, I think, I grew up listening to soundtracks, you know, once I got into music. And so to me, I really get a lot of joy out of that. And that's an important part of my experience. And so I like to be able to, I appreciate being able to write in that way myself.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is such a powerful thing. I know in the lives of at least my kids and their friends, right, that this music is sort of the backdrop to so many moments, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I joked about the car pickup line, but this music goes with us. You know, it's different than it used to be. It can be with us everywhere, and I'm sure that's a sort of this like unique responsibility, you know, to make sure that it's enjoyable in these different formats. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah.
This episode of MPU is brought to you by ZocDoc. You shouldn't have to feel awkward talking to your doctor. The good news is ZocDoc is the place where you can find and book doctors who make you feel comfortable and actually listen to you. We're talking about tens of thousands of doctors here, all with verified patient reviews, so you can make sure they're the right fit before you meet them in real life. With ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. It's a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doctor you want, you can book them immediately. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with the receptionist. And all of these doctors have verified reviews from actual, real patients. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it, and you can even score same-day appointments. Having a doctor you can communicate with openly, honestly, who listens to you, it is so important. I have found that in my family doctor, and with ZocDoc, you can too. Go to ZocDoc.com/MPU. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/MPU. There you can download the app for free, then find and book a top-rated doctor today. Our thanks to ZocDoc for sponsoring the show and Relay FM.
So the Cubase is where you write the melody and build out the score.
Right.
And then what happens next? So you get your cues in line, you're starting to put together the units of music that go into this movie. Mm-hmm. What's the next step in the workflow?
So each unit is called a cue, by the way. That's the the terminology we use. So a piece of music that's 2 minutes long, that's called a cue. And so then after I've written the cue, there's a playback session for the directors and producers and whoever needs to be hearing the music. So that's where they will listen to picture. They'll watch the picture, and then my music has been dropped in by the music editor to be in sync with that picture. And so the directors will watch it through and give you notes. You know, fortunately, I got really lucky again on Wish, where I got some notes, but I didn't get a tremendous amount. My directors were fantastic. They were just lovely people and great collaborators. You get your notes, and then the first thing you do I had either 6 or 7 weeks to compose the whole score for Wish. So that included all that playback session and all these playback sessions. And so about every 10 days, we would have a playback session. So the first thing you do then after a playback session is you address the notes. So I'd go back into my sequences, my cue-based sequences, and change the things that needed to be changed. And then I'd move on to the next batch of new music that I had to write for that next 10 days.
Okay. And for that, when you do the sessions, I'm assuming you're just using MIDI instruments on your computer. You're not putting like musicians together at this point, right?
Almost entirely true. So yes, the vast majority of the music is MIDI at this point. And there were moments where I would play. Probably see in the background, I've got some guitars and different instruments and stuff like that. So on the demos only, because I'm a horrible player, but sometimes I would play guitar, because especially in Wish, it's a very guitar, part of the sound is flamenco guitar, Spanish guitar.
Yeah.
And so so I would, for the demos, I would sometimes, instead of using MIDI samples with guitars, it would sound better if I would try to play it real wise. Of course, I would have to play it a bar at a time and then punch myself in. So I had to build these. Yeah. I'm not a guitar player.
I can see that.
Yeah. So that was an example. Sometimes I would play bass parts, because I'm a decent bass player, so I could play a better bass demo than a MIDI sample is going to sound. The biggest thing that I was able to do in Wish was I reached a point where I realized that it was going to be faster if I would use a real guitar player for my guitar demos, because again, it was a very important part of the score. So I pitched to Disney, and they were okay with using the guy who actually ended up being the guitar player in the score, George Dering, who's played on 10 bajillion film soundtracks in his career and is not only the most amazing guitar player who has every instrument known to man, stringed instrument known to man that he will play for you, but is also an incredibly lovely person, just a great guy. And so so I would write out actually then the guitar parts that I wanted George to play and send it to him. And then we would have a Zoom session where he'd record into Pro Tools at his studio. He's got a beautiful studio in Southern California. And so we would Zoom and he would record, and I would sort of say, hey, can you play it a little bit differently? He would then send those files to my music editor. My music editor would drop them into my sequence, and they would be, all of a sudden I would have these beautiful final guitar parts that were there. And it also then saved having to re-record them again down the road. So it was actually more efficient to work that way.
Yeah. And just, I'm thinking back for folks listening who aren't familiar with this, MIDI instruments are software instruments. On computers now, you can have a decent sounding trumpet or a cello, and then it's not as good as an actual instrument, and it doesn't have the same, feel.
Yep.
But you can have software instruments. So when you do these demos, as you're going through testing it out, they can kind of hear what it'll sound like with an orchestra.
Exactly. And I'm very, I guess, can I use the word anal?
Yeah, okay.
I'm very anal in my mock-ups. These are called mock-ups when you're doing a demo. And I'm very, I take it really seriously. And so even though the real musicians kill my demos, my mock-ups, because they bring the experience and the musicality and the humanity and the breath and all that stuff that you can't do with these samples. But my mockups are written exactly how they're going to be recorded by, you know, by the real musicians. So my violin one part, I have a separate track for violin one, violin two, viola, cello, bass. I write those tracks exactly as they're going to be orchestrated and then performed by the live musicians, as opposed to some composers will just have one string patch for all the string parts and they play all the string. They don't delineate between the different sections of the string section, say. So my demos are nowhere near as good as the live musicians, but they're very representative for the directors of what they're going to hear when we get to the recording studio. So, and you're correct, those are all software instruments. They're samples of live violin sections, of live trumpet sections, of live cello soloist, etc. So they sound like real musicians. They're representative, but they're not nearly as good.
I guess in a way that is sort of in parallel with the video side. How are you talking about? You may get a scene that is hand drawn or rough animation, and then it's evolving and becoming more finalized as your parts are becoming more finalized.
Right, exactly. The great thing of MIDI and of computers and stuff, it's kind of a double-edged sword in a way, right? The absolute beauty thing is it allows you to do a very accurate mock-up and play the directors so that they hear the music before you get into the studio, whether you got 100 musicians sitting out there in an incredibly expensive studio with engineers and editors and all that stuff sitting around. So it allows, in the old days before mock-ups, it was maybe you had a little more, freedom to write, maybe, because the first time anybody would hear it would be in the studio, and it was very expensive to change stuff. So in some ways, the composer maybe had more control of the music back, 30 years ago than you do today. But there's no going back, right? It's the genie out of the bottle. And used properly as a tool, like so much technology, right? It's a huge advantage too, right? You can really present what the music's going to sound like before you get boxed in and you're panicking on the stage when you have 100 people sitting out there waiting while sure. you write a scene, so where I've been in that boat too, so I've had to do that. So this way is pretty cool.
Yeah. They're like, really? There's that many, would we need that many much brass? And you're like, hey, although I will say I've never heard a good MIDI saxophone, but maybe that's me being a saxophone player.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's like the final frontier that nobody's really fully cracked yet.
On the point of MIDI, though, I want to follow up on that. There's a tech question. Historically, that has been very demanding of a computer. These MIDI models are very large files. What it is usually is it's a modeled note of each instrument, which is massive files.
Right.
And you need a lot of compute power, especially if you're going to have 5 violins and 3 cellos, and like when you have individual instruments for each track, as you do, I would imagine that's pretty demanding on your computer. Is that what hardware are you using to do that, and has it got easier over the years?
Oh man, I mean, starting there, it's gotten so much easier. I got into tech, when I had a DX7 way back in the first, 1982 or whenever they came out, and my first computer was can I say other companies? Yeah,
it's not even around anymore.
Yeah. So my first computer was an Atari ST 1040.
Yeah.
No hard drive in it, so
built-in MIDI ports.
There you go. That was the big reason I bought it, actually. And so, and then I shortly jumped over to a Mac. And I want to say, my first Mac was an SE that I hot rodded up then, it would have been the mid 80s. But so I've been around for a long time. And back, when I started, you couldn't even dream of doing any of this stuff, right? The sequencing was so rudimentary and there were no samples. It was all using computer type sounds. There was, it was like a different world, but over the years then, my first big foray into really going all in on being able to do great mockups, it was computer sounds. They weren't even in all these samples we've been talking about weren't even in computers yet. You had to have specialized sample units. So Roland, I had like 32 Roland S760 samplers that they each, I think they maxed out it. You could buy the extra RAM. They maxed out at 1 megabyte of RAM, right? So you can figure I had 32 megabytes of sound to do a whole orchestra, but you could do you could at least get it to sound like a, real instrument, even though you didn't have a lot of articulation options. You didn't have, a lot of, trills, you couldn't do sampled short notes, whatever. It was very limited palette, but I did that in like the mid 90s. That's what you could do. You couldn't do anything. Then you got to the point of where it would have been the early aughts. There was Giga Studio was a software that came around. It was only on PCs, but that was a huge jump because then all of a sudden you could buy like six PCs. So I had six custom built PCs that I'd made, you know, that were maxed out at the time. And so that replaced those 32 units. And so it got to that. And then that was the main thing for like a number of years. And then it got to the point of where Macs were able to kind of, the software was up to the point of the Macs. And I want to say that was around, I don't know, 2007 or something maybe. And so then I started buying a whole bunch of Mac Minis. You know, I had like, I think seven or eight Mac Minis for a while that all of my samples were loaded up into. And so of course this is all on a network. You know, I've got a whole wide array of networks. Then it got down to the point of where I had three Mac Pros, you know, the trash cans, you know, whenever that was that 2011, 12. Sorry, I hope trash cans isn't derogatory.
You are not the first person to use that term on this show.
But I love those computers. They were great because it let me get out of, you know, a billion Mac Minis, you know, into just a couple computers. So that got me through up until maybe, well, actually it was right before Wish. And I was using that kind of a system for a long time. And then it was when the first Mac Studio came out, I jumped on that baby. And that was, so I had the M1 maxed out. So I think that was 128 gigs of RAM, right? And I only had the 8 terabyte internal hard drive, but I also had an array of SSDs. So I had four 8 terabyte SSDs aligned in an array where my samples were stored. And so that was great because that was the first time, guys, that I was able to do everything in one computer. Wow. All of a sudden, I didn't need, you know, networked computers. So then after in the middle of Wish is when they came out with the M2 Studio, you know, Mac Studio. So I bought one of those and I didn't integrate it because you don't want to change horses in the middle of a project, right? But I bought the M2 maxed out. So I got, 192 gigabytes of RAM in it. Again, 8 terabyte storage, but I went upgraded even my hard drives to even faster. They're not SSDs. They're, you guys know the terminology, I've forgotten. They're the little blades.
Like a NVMe storage.
There you go. Yep. That's it. Thank you. And so I've got 32 terabytes of that now rated out going into the Mac, into this M2, you know, Mac Studio. And it's stunning. I mean, because it's not only the samples, right, that I got in there, but it's all the plugins. I got all these reverb plugins. I got all these compressors. I got all these, you know, other things that go into making music too, that this computer, it just like things that would have brought, you know, my old system to its knees, you know, my 3 year ago system to its knees. This computer, just like I look at my meter and it's like, it's barely got, you know, hitting anything, you know? Wow. And so it's been life-changing. It's a dream come true for me to finally get to that I was around long enough to reach, you know, to where the computers are there that I always dreamed of.
It's funny because I thought when they came out with the Mac Pro, it's controversial now because it doesn't do a lot, but I thought, well, would that be something for music production? But it sounds like even that, it doesn't work for you either.
You know, it sort of depends, right? Because the great thing about those is they have the card slots. And the Mac Studio doesn't have the card slot. So some people, like if you're still running a Pro Tools system or certain systems in the music world, that's valuable and important. But for me, you know, I've got a Thunderbolt, I think it's a 4 chassis, it might be a 3, but you know, where I've got my my audio interface card into, it's an RME card, and that is capable of running, you know, 196 channels of audio. And so that in that chassis running Thunderbolt 3 or 4, it's way fast enough, so I don't need a card for my situation. So that's why I looked at it, you know, I was that close to pulling the trigger on a Pro before the generation before the Studios came out. You know, I gotta say I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad I went the Studio way, because it's like, you know, the size of those things, right? Crazy.
It's remarkable.
It's just crazy how great those computers are and for the size.
So if you're listening to this and you've got a Mac Studio on your desk, just realize that that's the same computer that he scored and wrote the music for Wish on.
Yeah,
right.
And that really is a testament to how far Apple's come.
I totally agree. You know, totally agree. Apple totally nailed that computer. You know, they've done a lot of great things, but that that Mac Studio, especially it's the Ultra, right? It's been a while, but yeah, but that, especially that, is just unbelievable in my book.
This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by Indeed. Go to Indeed.com/MPU and join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide using Indeed to hire great talent fast. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. So ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with the candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. If you've ever hired anybody, you know how important it is that you get the right person. You want to find the person with the right qualifications, with the right mindset, with the right chemistry for your company. Well, Indeed takes the work out of that. No longer do you have to sift through the resumes of unqualified candidates. Indeed brings you only qualified people. And leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the Mac Power Users will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your job more visibility at Indeed.com/MPU. Just go to Indeed.com/MPU right now and support our show by saying you heard about it here on the Mac Power Users. Indeed.com/MPU is the URL. Check it out. Terms and conditions apply. But do you need to hire? You need Indeed. And our thanks to Indeed for their support of the Mac Power Users and all of Relay FM.
So that's a lot of data. You've got your samples. You've got your working files. I'm sure you've got archives of stuff as well.
Yep.
How do you manage making sure all that stuff is backed up and kept safe?
Yeah, I'm pretty darn redundant because obviously, everybody should be, and as most people are. But so I've got multiple things. I've got cloud backup every day that goes out. I have on site three redundant backups that are all scheduled. You know, I've got a monthly, I've got a weekly, and I've got a daily on site as well that back up. And then I actually even back up my cloud back. You know, it circles back. So I've got an on site. So it's, I try to, it's always the fear, right, that you're going to have a catastrophic crash, which does still happen, or you're going to have a fire or theft or who knows, all the things, the bad things could happen. And the big thing is I just, don't want to be caught, like any business, right? And personal wise too, you don't want to lose all your pictures or whatever, but
sure,
if you don't have to. But so I'm very paranoid about packing things up. And so
yeah, it's not paranoia. I mean, like you said, as good as these systems are, things still can go wrong. And even it may not be, a hard drive literally crashing the way it used to be. All those other things are still possible. And I was just, he's saying, 30 terabytes of SSD, like part of my, my eyes rolled back in my head a little bit because that sounds incredible. I'm sitting here at my desk with 20 terabytes of SSD. So you're still out ahead of me. But it is just remarkable how much that has come along. I am curious though about some of the other Apple devices, right? So you've got your Mac Studio, that's the heart of your workspace, but what about the iPhone and iPad? Are those strictly personal devices for you? Do they have a use in your work as well? How do they fit in?
Yeah, well, the iPhone, is mostly personal, just, because I'm of a generation, I suppose, that it's actually amazing. I know how to operate a phone, period. But I suppose it's business related because that's still a communication link that I use, for everybody. But the thing that is really critical in my world is an iPad. And I've got a iPad Pro, you guys can't see it, but it's right in front of me, that is just critical. I use Metagrid, is the software, the app that I've got on there. And it's all customized as far as my most important shortcuts are on that iPad right in front of me. Anybody who knows that program knows it'll switch depending on the software you're using. We haven't talked about it, but I also, not only do I use Cubase for sequencing, but I also have to deal with notation as well. Cubase is a great program, but it doesn't print up the scores and stuff. So I use also then Sibelius. I've been a Sibelius user now for quite a while. And so whenever I flip over to Sibelius Metagrid, my shortcuts flip over to that and come up. I'm also getting into Dorco at this point, which is another Steinberg program, and I'm really intrigued by that and for notation. But so the iPad is, I couldn't live. Honestly, when I'm traveling, that's goes with me just because I would be lost, right? You know how it is. You know, you get your shortcuts. And the reason I use Metagrid is because I don't want to have to remember the key commands. And so when you can customize your most important deep detailed shortcuts, I don't want to have to remember key command. I can just push the button. I see what it is. Boom, it's there and done. So
yeah. And just for anybody that got lost on that. So Metagrid is a control surface app. So you can put it under your Mac or next to your Mac, and you can use it as a control surface for your Mac. So he's using Metagrid on an iPad basically as a souped up Stream Deck, you know, and it does everything you want. It changes by the app, and you can very customize the layout. And you talked about this in the last time you're on the show. I'm glad to hear that you're still using it. So that's still the one to go to, Metagrid.
Yeah. I've jumped around, you know, there's obviously other options, but that one is the one that's worked the best for me. They actually have a newer version of it that is really deep. It's deeper, but it's Metagrid Pro, I believe is the, and I've messed around with it, but the cool thing about it, I mean, there's a lot of cool things about it, but it kind of like, I felt more secure just with the basic original one. So, and I've done all my shortcuts are in there. They're always evolving. You know, I mean, I'm always swapping them out if I find something that works better, but it just works for me. I love it. I couldn't live without it, honestly. And I don't know if you want to move on, but that's my other Apple thing. I do have other tidbits. In fact, David, you brought up Stream Deck, and I'm just saying your thing, you know, on the wall in the background, you've probably heard this before, but that is just a ginormous Stream Deck you got on your wall. I mean, yeah. I see that and I go, that's like, you must have some super in with them because you got like this giant Stream Deck with a million buttons. But anyway, sorry for the people that can't see it, but I,
it's actually not a Stream Deck. It's a Vesta board. It's a titling thing. I've been shooting some videos. So I have some titles.
Oh, cool. Oh man. Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. And I see that now, but I saw it when we first got on. I was going, man, that is like one really ripping Stream Deck you got there.
It's like a Vanna White size Stream Deck, you know.
but I will say that I have several Stream Decks, and you inspired me last time we interviewed you, because you've got, not only do you have the iPad, you do have several third-party devices that you use to control everything.
Yeah.
What all do you have plugged into your Mac at this point?
Well, do you mind if I just sort of go from left to right?
Perfect. Yeah, go for it.
I've got a... well, golly, I wish I could show this to you, but my camera's mounted. Anyway, there's a, I have like a audio controller that controls the volume of my speakers and switches all that, but that's not really, it's plugged into the Mac, but kind of indirectly. This company, I've had a whole bunch of them. They're MIDI faders. And so they'll send data. So like when you're doing your mock-up to make the violin sound more realistic, you can send MIDI CCs, which are MIDI controllers, continuous controllers, that I've programmed into my samples that will give lifelike, they change the volume, or they change the, you go from a piano sound, it'll transition up to fortissimo, you know, and vibrato, things like that. So it's a four MIDI faders that will, you know, send that information. I can record it into Cubase, into my sequencer. So that's on my pure left. I have a double stack of, on the top is a Stream Deck. What are they called? XE?
What XL.
XL, the big one? Yeah. Yep, the big one.
Yeah.
Which, again, it depends on if I'm in Cubase or Sibelius or Dorico, will flip to the appropriate shortcuts. And on that one, I've got, like, shortcuts for distribute when I'm in the orchestration mode of my mockup that will copy, go to the different instrument and paste into it, you know, what my from my guide piano that we were talking about. So it's a way faster way to get the mockups done for me. You know, it works with it. It takes the programming time, but it's worth it because it saves massive amount of time when you're writing. That's the main thing. In Sibelius, it actually has my dynamics and accents, things like that. Below it is a, and we talked about this before, and I don't think I've still learned how to pronounce it, but LoopDeck, I believe is how it's pronounced. Yeah. But so I've got the one that has the, it's on the outsides, there's three dials on each side. So there's six dials all together, and in the middle, it's like a series of, it's a grid, a 4x3 grid of different buttons. And so that's where I have shortcuts for muting dialogue and muting muting the sound effect track in the video when I'm working on it. And my knobs are priceless because that's where I will, I have shortcuts I program for quickly changing the volume levels or the modulation, the MIDI CC levels that I was just talking about. So that's like again, speeds up. This is all about speed and efficiency and not having to think about, you know, it's like making it as the tools as transparent as it possibly can be, right?
Yeah, and we don't talk about LoopDeck much on the show because neither Steven or I have one, but it is a it in some ways it's less than a Stream Deck, in some ways it's a lot more, and the way it's a lot more is, as I understand it, the dials are just top notch dials. So if you do like high end video edits, photo edits, music work, and you want really good dials attached to your Mac, this is probably the best hardware for that.
Yep, you're so right. And that was kind of like, I had like the original LoopDeck, you know, and I use it for a while and I then swapped it out for the Stream Deck, still worked better for me, kind of. But the LoopDeck with the dials was just like perfect for me. And it fits on my, it's on my left-hand side. So I got my mouse going with my right hand and my left hand, then I can just be dialing in things, you know, so it's like ergonomics too, right, is works for me. So that's a great unit. Well, they're all great units. We talked about my iPad in front of me. Right below my iPad is a company. Oh, man, I can't remember the name of the company. I'm going to crack one off for you. But I, between my keypad.
They're modular,
they're
right?
Totally modular, right. So I've got a row going across the front between my iPad and my Mac keyboard where I've got six dials and then five buttons. And what those are is those will advance, like I've got it set up. Well, you can see one, the farthest one will advance in Cubase a frame at a time. Remember earlier we talked about there are 24 frames in a second of film, right? So that helps me dial in when I'm locating, you know, like a hit point, like we were talking about, right? So I'll use that to dial in, you know, find the moments. The next one I've got set up to, it events, it moves. I can highlight a little frame in of MIDI information, and it'll slide things by a frame or to either direction, or it'll move MIDI notes or whatever. So it's those are the sort of things that instead of having to remember what key is it on the Mac that does on my Mac keyboard that does it, it's right there. And since it's a dial, you just dial it in, you know, instead of having to like do a plus and a minus or whatever it is, right? And I have my click volume, you know, for my metronome, you know, when you're writing. You to tempo or to picture you want to hear a metronome, so I can turn it on or off or whatever. So it's all these cool things that just make life faster and easier. And since they're so small, it just fits right there perfectly. You know. So did you find what it is, David? Were you able to find?
I think it's Monogram.
Yes, Monogram. That's it. Yep.
Yeah.
And it comes with a little app in, you know, on your Mac that you can customize any of those buttons to be whatever it is, or dials to be whatever you want to be. So that's another gold mine that I, you know, all of them, they're all critical.
I feel like all these manufacturers have you on a list. They're like, give me a list of the whales. You got something new.
We have a thing with buttons on it. Call Dave.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know if I'm a whale. I'm not a whale. I'll tell you that. But I am a absolute addict to this stuff, right? You know?
Yeah.
And so I buy them all. Whenever they come out, I buy them all because there might be something that is life-changing, you know, or efficiency making. So
yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing. What you're doing is super complicated. you're essentially virtually recording an orchestra weekly.
Daily. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Really. And so anything you can do to save, we talked about this before, mental bandwidth on the software, to get the software to be a part of an extension of your mind, essentially is what it is. Right. That's a plus. Yeah. And these are the things in my world, at least, that enable that for me. Right.
Another thing that stands out to me today, listening to you talk about this in the way like you're using faders and whatnot, is you're actually kind of performing these recordings for the temp tracks. In order to add the effects and stuff, you must be there running the dials while it's kind of recording in.
Absolutely.
So then you can share it with them.
That's right. And it makes it more realistic. And you're right, David, that's exactly it. When you're doing the mockups, you are essentially, and there's no way, I mean, I'm not equating myself to the actual live musicians, but you are the complete orchestra, right? For that moment, for that necessity of the process, the composer is the whole orchestra. And the thing is, you know, not everybody gets in, does it as deeply as I kind of do. You know, there are some people that will kind of do a little bit of the Medici's wheel moves, you know, and other people won't do it at all. But to me, it adds that level of realism that makes it closer to what it's going to be for the directors when they're signing off on the cues. So that's better for them. It's better for me, because if they can hear what it's really going to sound like in a more realistic way, they're more likely to sign off on it. So it helps everybody, frankly. Takes more work, but it's worth it.
I think I know the answer to this question, but does the studio musicians hear any of these cues at all, or they just show up and read the music?
Everybody knows, you know, it's a reality, you know, at this point. So some composers, especially in the past, would used to play the demos for the musicians. To me, that's not necessary. And because I don't really necessarily want them to hear my demo, because I want them to beat my demo, and they always do, you know? So I really don't do that. There are times like we're talking about George, the guitar player, right? He's playing to my mock-up. So he hears my mock-up, because he has to hear something to reference, you know, when he's playing the guitar parts, recording the guitar parts. So that's a case of where George, you know, was hearing that, but they usually don't hear. And I honestly don't think they should hear. I think you know, it's the miracle of what they do should be preserved and appreciated. So
a lifetime of dedication to the violin means they're going to make that violin track sound better than you ever could with your dials.
Absolutely, right. And I don't want this to ever come off that, oh man, Metzger, you know, like he is looking to replace musicians or whatever. That's the farthest thing for me and what I do here. And I would never do that. I've been fortunate. I've never had to do that. Right. I've always been able to replace my mockups with the live musicians. And because that's what it's all about. It's about those live folks and what they bring.
Can we go to that part of it then? So once you've gone through and you've used all your gear, you've made the mockups and the directors have signed off, at some point you end up in a big room with a lot of musicians.
Yeah.
So what steps happen in that period? What happens?
Yeah. So after after my mockup is signed off by the directors, and I've made all the changes that they've, you know, wanted, then it gets my MIDI file, my Cubase file gets orchestrated. And in the past, I've always, especially in my case, I've written very specifically all the parts. So it really is a transcription, essentially, of my Cubase file into a notated piece of music, a score. And so that score then, that being said, you know, what's the order? Okay, so in the past, I've orchestrated everything that I've ever done my mock-up on.
That was your job often.
Exactly, right. And so, and that's something that I always am very, you know, is very meaningful to me, because that's the actual what the music is, right? You know, that's going to be played. But in the case of Wish, then for the first time, I wasn't able to, because of the time constraints, I wasn't able to do the orchestration myself, meaning that translation from my Cubase. So I had to let that go. That was actually very emotionally difficult for me to do.
Bet it was, right?
You know, and so
it must have been hard for the person who did it too, saying, oh man, David always does this. He's not going to like whatever I do.
It could have been, but I got the most amazing guy to do it for me. The guy named Dave Julie, who is a great orchestrator, and he's a really smart guy. And so, and we went into it with the understanding that that he would be okay if I would go through his work and make changes if there was something I just wanted to see differently, right? And so he was totally cool with that. And to do that, then he was also willing to use my Sibelius template, you know, because everybody has their own template that has their shortcuts in or whatever, you know. So David was very gracious about letting me do that and also then using my template. So I ended up orchestrating all the songs. I ended up orchestrating maybe, I don't know, 7 minutes, maybe out of 64 minutes of score, you know, because that was all I really had time to do that I did all myself, but David did the rest of it. But again, I went through every score and went through every part because it's part of my analyst, you know, and made a few changes here and there, but he just knocked it out of the park. He did a great job. He also, the thing that he went above and beyond is that he works in the music preparation department of Disney. So he's copied my scores for as long as he's been working. You know, I think he maybe came on to the company in, you know, let's say around the time of Frozen. So he's seen a lot of my work, my scores. So he knows my tendencies. But the great thing is he spent a couple, 3 weeks, I think he told me, literally studying my scores. So he got my scores from Frozen and from Moana. And he studied how I notate. When do I put a crescendo and, you know, when do I, you know, how do I notate staccato, you know, or whatever, you know, these things that are very individually, you know, specific by depending on the different orchestrator or composer. So he took the time to really study before he even started working on it, which meant a ton to me. So I really kind of got the best of both worlds. I didn't have the time to do it myself, but I got a person who did a great job of doing it as I would have done it and was also happy to let me take one pass to kind of make it the way in the final couple of ways. So sorry, I got way off, but I'm a big fan of Dave Julie's and he was very, very helpful to me.
And then, you know, this dream that started when you saw that space movie at the age 16, you show up in a studio, presumably in LA somewhere.
That's right. We were at Fox, 20th Century Fox in Century City. Yep.
And a group of musicians go in there and play your music. What was it? What did that feel like?
Well, I'll tell you, I've been around a long time as we've talked, but I've never had that feeling of the first scoring session, the first minute sitting down there in the chair, you know, because the way I have Don Harper, my dear friend, was my conductor. So he's out there with the musicians and I'm in the control booth sitting at the big giant desk, you know, with a, you know, I don't know, I don't know, 70, 80, you know, 80, 96 channels probably of faders, you know, and I'm sitting right there in the middle in the chair and the first, you know, moment of hearing the music, my music being played with my name on it, you know, and I'm the composer of the whole film. It was very, very emotional. And it was, the dream come true. And the other thing too, David, you know, and Stephen, that was even better is a lot of those musicians in that orchestra in LA, I've been friends of mine for, you know, in some cases up to 40 years ago, you know, 40 years. My principal trumpet player is Wayne Bergeron, who was Maynard's, you know.
I know who Wayne Bergeron
exactly,
is.
Exactly. Yes. Maynard's lead trumpet player. And he and I go back, Alex Iles, Andy Martin, all these guys that are people that I was in rehearsal bands with when I was in college, you know. And so a lot of those guys were out there and in the intervening time, I've gotten to know all of those musicians in LA so well from my career. And so it was doubly emotionally impactful for me to get those musicians to play that music. I'm on the edge of tears thinking about it because it just was just such an unbelievable experience. And
sure.
Well, David, congratulations again. I can't wait to see what you do next. I'm going to be watching all the Disney posters now very carefully for whoever composed the music. And it is, as a fellow Mac Power user, we're all very happy for you with this big move. Again, go check out Wish. I also want to say again, that was it the, what was the short called again?
Once Upon a Studio.
Once Upon a Studio. I watched it and then I went back and watched it again because I liked it so much. It's a little story of like what happens in the Disney Animation Studio when all the humans go home And exactly. It's just a cute little thing. It celebrates 100 years of the company.
Exactly.
And it's great. You know, my wife got that picture they take at the end of that video.
Yeah.
My wife got one of those because she works for the company. It's on my list. She wants me to make her a frame for it so we can hang it up. And maybe I'll send it to you and have you sign it. But the
it would lower the value of it.
No. Either way, thanks a lot. I know this wasn't as heavy a Mac Power Users episode, but we've never had a chance to talk to somebody about this whole process. And the Mac does play a pivotal role for you.
It's huge. Yeah. Yep.
Either way, thank you, everybody, for sticking along with us. Thank you, David, for your time today. Thank you to our sponsors, NetSuite, ZocDoc, and Indeed. We are the Mac Power Users. You can find us at relay.fm/MPU. David, where can people go to find out more about the stuff you're doing?
Probably the best place would be my website, www.davemetzgermusic.com, all one word.
And gang, if you want to check out the extended version of the Mac Power Users, the More Power Users, you get the ad-free version today. We're going to be talking about matte screens. Very sexy topic coming up in the More Power Users. You can learn about that at relay.fm/MPU. And we'll see you next time.